guys, welcome back to the podcast. I named this episode The Parent Trap because it's like something out of a movie. There are twins involved, but there's also a bad marriage, money, greed off the charts, and murder. So some of my American listeners might know about this case already because, you know, it was very sensational when it happened. But if you don't, I'm going to explain how the murder of this very well-respected Texas millionaire named Stephen Beard happened. And all of it started late one night when Stephen called 911 from his bedroom. And he was on the phone with the dispatcher and he said, "My guts just blew out of my stomach," and he was screaming for help. Now, maybe you're thinking he might have just had surgery or something. Maybe he tore open some stitches. That's what the police and the first responders thought too, until they came into his bedroom and they found a shotgun shell on the floor. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Let's first of all talk about the victim of today's case. Stephen Beard was born on the 27th of January in 1924, and he really had one of those rags to riches stories. He was born into a poor family from Dallas, Texas, but he was ambitious from a very young age. He thought about becoming a doctor, but when World War II happened, Steve joined the US Navy and it kind of derailed his plans of going in a medical career. When he came home after the war, he started working at a department store, and that's where he met Elise Adams. In 1951, he and Elise got married, and over time they had three children together. Stephen III, a daughter named Becky, and then another son named Paul. But life wasn't easy for them. Steve's job didn't pay them a lot of money, and now he had a wife and children to take care of. So the family decided to move to Austin in the hopes of getting better opportunities and having a better life. Steve started working in advertising in a kind of a low-tier job at first, but because he was so smart and hard-working, he quickly progressed up the ladder. By 1978, Steve was a top-level executive and, you know, he was always like a very independent and driven person, and that got him very far in life. But besides just being like hard-working and driven, people said that he was very funny and warm and generous and witty. So he wasn't just like a corporate workaholic guy. He had a great personality too. After he was, you know, a top level executive, he also decided to co-found a television station called KBVO-TV as he was still continuing his executive job at the same time. He was also a very hands-on dad. Steve would spend lots of time riding horses and going fishing with his kids at their ranch. He loved having, you know, time with them. But even though his career was at an all-time high, his personal life fell apart in 1973 when his beloved wife Elise died after a battle with cancer. He had cared for Elise until the very end of her life, and he would put on her lipstick for her every single morning. And he was very, very heartbroken without her. After this happened, Steve decided to sell the TV station for $54 million, which made him a very, very rich man. And now he was retired, so he started spending more and more of his time at the very exclusive Austin Country Club, which was a private members only club. It was a very prestigious place in Texas, and the initial fee to like become a member was $125,000 per person. It was there at the Austin Country Club that he met Celeste Martinez, who was working as a waitress at the club. Now, Steve had been living alone since his wife Elise's death, and he was retired now, and his kids were adults, and you know, he was just really lonely. He was really, really lonely, and the loneliness was terrible for him. He began spending more and more of his day at the country club just to have some company from other people. You know what I mean? Like he was an elderly man now, and his kids were grown up. They had their own lives. He was a widower. you know, his only kind of real social outlet was at this country club. So he was coming there more and more during the day, and then he would stay longer and longer in the evenings. And that's where he met Celeste and, you know, began chatting to her and things like that. It wasn't long until Steve decided to hire Celeste as his housekeeper, having her move in with him very quickly. And within 6 months of meeting, Celeste had left her husband and decided to move in with Steve into his mansion. Now, Stephen's son thought that it was a bit odd when his father decided to bring his, quote, housekeeper as his companion to the Super Bowl. It was obvious to everyone that this lady wasn't really Steve's housekeeper, because he wasn't just like bringing her with him to these fancy expensive events. He'd also replaced all of her clothes. He started taking her on cruises with him, on lavish foreign trips. And Steve's friends were kind of a little bit concerned for him about having this new and much younger girlfriend. So let's talk a bit about Celeste and who she was, because she's also a very central figure in this case. By the time Steve and Celeste meet each other at the Austin Country Club, he's 70 years old and she's 32 years old. She's blonde, she's attractive, she's charming, and she's very much one of those people that likes to have fun and likes to be in the center of it all. She likes to party. But, you know, despite like the lovely smile and the fun personality, Celeste has a lot going on under the surface. She was born on February the 13th in 1963 in Culver City, California, and she was adopted at a young age, I think basically as a baby, by a couple named Nancy and Edwin Johnson. She was only, you know, a teenager when she got married. She was only 17 years old, and she had married like her high school boyfriend, a guy named Craig Bratcher, and she was pregnant at the time, so I don't know how much of it was like just that time period where like a boy gets you pregnant, you have to get married. You know what I mean? I don't know if that was the kind of thing or if she really did love Craig and they wanted to be together. But anyway, she was 17 when she got married and she was already pregnant. She eventually gave birth to two twin daughters with Craig, Christina and Jennifer. But early on in the marriage, Craig just decided to relocate the entire family to Washington State without really consulting Celeste at all. You know, he didn't really ask if she wanted to move or where she would like to move or if she was okay moving. And she didn't he didn't really factor in, like, how are you going to move with two twin babies and like the stress of all of that. So Celeste just had to kind of go along with it, and she had to quit her job. She went with him to Washington, but she wasn't really happy about it. And it didn't take long before the marriage with Craig broke down and they got divorced. Now, money was always tight for Celeste, and she often kind of lived in a hand-to-mouth type of situation. You know, there was never money for much else. By 1988, she moved to Phoenix, and there she got married to another man named Henry Wolfe, but that marriage didn't last long either. And then by 1991, Celeste is now 28 years old and she was on her way to getting married to her third husband, a guy named Jimmy Martinez. And apparently Celeste was like crazy about Jimmy. So when Jimmy says, "I'm getting a job in Austin, I'm leaving Phoenix, I'm getting a job in Austin," she says, "Okay, well, I'll come with you." So that's how Celeste goes from California to Washington to Phoenix to Austin. And that's, you know, how she gets to the Austin Country Club. However, she has, I think, at this time, she had custody of both Christina and Jennifer, the two twins. But it was around this time that Jennifer decided that she didn't want to live with her mother anymore, and she went to live with her father, Craig. Because I think the situation for the two girls was very difficult living with their mother, because their mother was very much all about her boyfriend or all about the man in her life, and the girls were just kind of tagging along. And I think for Jennifer, like, once this move to from Phoenix to Austin was announced, she was like, no, I'm done, I'm leaving. So Jennifer decided to go live with her father, Craig. So now Christina, the other twin, she's living with her mother, and her twin sister is now states away living with Craig. And I know that was very hard on the two girls. Like, they did not want to be apart. They wanted to be together. They were happy to be together. But I think the situation that their mother was putting them in, with all this moving around and all these different guys, it wasn't good. So their childhood hadn't been very stable at all. Like I was saying, Celeste wouldn't always have a lot of money. She was not a stable person. The men in their lives weren't stable influences. And sometimes Celeste would literally just drop them off at a foster home with no explanation. The girls would go on to say that Celeste had neglected them a lot, and she would often focus more on her next man than her two children. Their mother, she was very unpredictable, and the girls didn't really have a lot of stability, like I was saying. She kept moving them around. She kept marrying different guys and then breaking up with different guys and divorcing them. You know, she also really, Celeste really had no interest in, like, making a home, you know, making, like, a nice, warm home environment, or, like, giving the girls affection and, you know, stability like that, emotional support. Celeste's only, like, concerns were very much for herself. And the other thing to just note about Celeste, she's a very intense manipulator. She's great at manipulating people. So, like I was saying, she's got this lovely smile and, you know, this bubbly outward personality where she seems fun and youthful and very energetic and ready to party and have a great time. She can be very charming to people and draw people in, and she would kind of tell people just enough of the truth about herself that they would also believe the lies she told about herself. So keep all that in your mind as we go through the next series of events. So now it's Celeste and Christina, just the two of them, and they move with Jimmy to Texas, to Austin. And, you know, at this point, like, Celeste was very sick of living the way that she had lived her whole life. She was sick of struggling. She was sick of running out of money. She wanted to get rich, and she wanted that more than anything. Like, she was very much a material girl. So she got herself this job at this very fancy, exclusive country club. I don't exactly know how she got in the door there, but I'm guessing, again, like, her good looks, her personality, she was able to charm her way in the door. So, like I said, it was at this very affluent country club that she got the attention of Stephen Beard, who was one of the country club's most affluent members. It just so happened that, like, I'm guessing at some stage somebody else working there was telling her, like, oh, this person does this and this person is worth that much. And, like, she singled out Stephen. He was this lonely older man who was there all the time because he had, you know, he was retired and he had nobody to really go home to. So, you know, he was this retired TV executive and he had all this wealth and stability and mansions and, you know, she realized, like, he can take care of me. And so she began giving him more attention and spending more time with him, I'm guessing, at the country club. And it didn't really take long before Celeste, like I said, like, decided to divorce Jimmy so she could really solidify things with Steve. She was chasing that bag and she needed to lock him down quick. Now, from very early on, Steve's adult children were not happy about this new relationship. Beth, Stephen Jr. and Paul, they didn't think that any of this was a good idea, but they could see that their dad was really happy with Celeste. So, you know, they didn't think she was good for him. They didn't they didn't like the thing, the whole situation, I'm guessing. They thought it was probably weird that he was 70 and she was 30. But despite his family's misgivings about Celeste, Steve, you know, he was going to do what he was going to do. And he wanted to marry Celeste. So on February the 18th, 1995, Celeste and Steve were officially married. People in the community whispered and gossiped about it, obviously, but Steve didn't care. He was happy with things the way they were, but if you thought Celeste was marrying Steve out of any like affection for him or love for him, well, you would be very wrong. Thankfully, they did have a prenuptial agreement, but like this prenup is wild. Let me tell you, one of the terms of the prenup agreement was that Steve would give Celeste a pre-marriage gift of $500,000, and she was to receive a $35,000 a month allowance, and she would also get another $500,000 if they stayed married to each other for 3 years. Keep those numbers in mind. Remember, $500,000 if they stay married for 3 years. So Steve's friends, you know, his fancy rich friends, they knew that Celeste was just using him for his money. They knew it was obvious, like you couldn't hide it. They knew that Celeste and Steve had like nothing in common and that the marriage was just a kind of a charade for her. But again, Steve seemed happy and they didn't want to upset him, so they just went along with it. But Celeste, she got that $500,000, that first $500,000, that pre-marriage gift. She got that $500,000 and boy, was she in a hurry to spend it. She could not stop shopping. She would buy bags and bags of clothes and literally just leave them with the tags on them for months, if not years. She was just buying stuff and not even bothering to wear it. She had over $500,000 worth of jewelry from Steve, and she also had 26 fur coats. But, you know, Celeste blew through that $500,000. She blew through all of it in 6 months. But she didn't really care. To her, she had won the lottery. She had this beautiful new house to live in. It was the Beard Mansion in Taro Canyon. It was Steve's mansion. It was set in an upscale part of Austin nicknamed Lexusland. She had this gorgeous new house. She had more money than she could handle. You know, she was living a good life. And like, even if she ran out of money or her allowance ran up before, you know, that month was over, Steve would still pay for everything. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't going to say no to her about anything. She could burn through $35,000 in a week and he would still give her more. So she was fine. She didn't care. But in a very surprising turn of events, Craig, the twin girl's father, he took his own life in 1996, only 1 year after Celeste and Steve got married. So this forced Jennifer to move back in with her mother and Christina, and then her new stepfather, Steve. So Christina and Steve had been living together with Celeste for a year. They were close. So then it was kind of odd when like Jennifer just suddenly like moved in too. But now Celeste had both of her daughters under control. She had all the money in the world she could want. She was able to walk into the country club now as a member, no longer an employee. She had everything she ever wanted. Steve was literally her golden goose. Meanwhile, for Steve's part, he seemed very happy with the new arrangement because, and it's like sad to say, but like he wasn't lonely anymore. You know, like he just wanted company. He wanted family, you know. He might have married Celeste kind of impulsively, but she was very energetic and lively, and she livened up his life again. And his own kids were grown-ups now. They were moved out. They had their own lives. But now he had a new family, and he adopted Celeste's two daughters right before they turned 18. Like, he wanted to be a dad again, you know? Like, it's, he was happy to give Celeste all the money she wanted just to have her company and to be able to take care of her and to be able to take care of her two daughters. That's all. He wasn't out for anything else. Meanwhile, Jennifer and Christina, they're now going to this new fancy school. It's called Westlake High School. They're living in this fancy new house. They have all brand new clothes, all expensive stuff that they never would have afforded before in their lives. And it was all because of Steve. Like, he gave them a life that they had never even dreamed of having before. But if you thought that the two girls, you know, they're 17 years old and like a bit cynical or whatever, if you thought that they looked at Steve just based on his money the way their mother did, like, you'd be very wrong. They did not value Steve based on the stuff that he was buying them or the things that he was paying for. The two teenage girls genuinely adored Steve. They really appreciated and cared about Steve because for the first time, they were both living together in a stable home. That was the main thing. The two girls wanted to be together, and it wasn't always possible based on like their mother's actions or based on being in foster care, or, you know what I mean? They weren't always able to be together. So the fact that like they had this good life now, they were together again. Their mother was seemingly happy because she was just able to spend money and shop all day long. You know, for the first time, they were in this like stable living situation, this home. It was a home, and it was all thanks to Steve. He was the one who made the home like a homely place to be, not their mother. He would like cook hamburgers on the barbecue for them every single Wednesday. He would throw pool parties for the girls and their friends. Plus, he really cared about the two girls like they were his own. He wasn't just spending money on them and buying them things that they wanted. He would also be very loving and affectionate to the girls. He would hug them. He would make time for them in his day. He and Jennifer, you know, because obviously, like, they hadn't been living together as long as he and Christina had. He and Jennifer, like, he made time to get to know Jennifer. And eventually they got so close that they had a routine where they would go and get breakfast together every single weekend. You know, like, the two girls, they loved Steve, and they said that they got a lot more love and care and affection from Steve than they ever, ever got from their mother. So they truly valued him in their lives in a way that was not for his money, the way that their mother clearly did. She only valued him for his money. They truly had a lot of affection and love for Steve, and he clearly felt the same way for them. Otherwise, he wouldn't have bothered adopting them. You know what I mean? He didn't have to legally adopt his new wife's two teenage kids. That was out of the goodness of his heart, because he actually wanted them to be his family, not just like dependents. You know what I mean? So for a while, life in the Beard Mansion was good. Everyone was happy. Pretty much everyone was getting what they wanted out of this arrangement. Celeste, like I said, she had money to burn, which was really all she cared about. The two girls, they were stable, they were together, they were being nurtured and cared for in a way that they weren't used to before. Steve, he had young kids now in his life again, and so he was able to be a dad again. He had Celeste, he was able to, you know, walk around with her on his arm and have her for company and fun and all that good stuff. And for a while, things were really good. And if only it could have stayed that way. It could have, but, you know, Celeste being who she was, it was never, never going to stay that way for long. You would think that she would have appreciated this new normalcy and stability in her life, but that just wasn't in her nature. It didn't take long before she started being her usual chaotic self again. Now, remember that 3-year clause in the prenup agreement. Well, after that time passed, after the 3 years passed in the marriage, and Celeste presumably got her other $500,000 payout, This was when her messy side started coming out again. So she had tried to kind of keep a lid on it before the prenup agreement. So she was like, I'm going to wait 3 years. I'm going to get my other $500,000 from Steve. And then I can do whatever I want. And that's when things really started to slide downhill. So she, you know, as we know, she loves to party. She loves to get wild. She loves men. And this is basically, after that 3 years came and went, that's basically what she started doing. She started spending a lot of time partying. She would do stuff with other men, including her ex-husband, Jimmy Martinez. Oh yeah, he didn't leave her life. Like, just because she divorced him, Jimmy was always around. Like, she kept him around. And I think, I don't know, but like, I'm pretty sure, like, you know, she said to him, look, we'll get divorced. I'll marry Steve and we'll be, you know, we'll be gold, basically. Celeste could also be a very, like, inappropriate person. And a lot of times she wouldn't really act like an adult at all. Like, the two teenage girls, like, their friends would basically be like, that's your mom. Like, she wouldn't act like an adult, you know, like a responsible adult. She would be very inappropriate in front of her kids, in front of their friends, and she had no kind of shame about it either. And then she also didn't really bother to hide the fact that she wasn't being sexually fulfilled by her husband Steve. And she would, like, openly tell people that he was too old for her. And she would also tell people that, like, Jimmy could do things for her that Steve couldn't. And if that wasn't bad enough, that, like, she was talking and mocking him behind his back, she would, like, mock Steve very cruelly, verbally. She would mock him and she would call him names like Daddy Warbucks, or she'd call him fat ass, and she would disrespect him and exclude him from things as well. Like, she wasn't just, like, verbally being horrible and cruel. Like, she would actually, like, cut him out of things on purpose so he couldn't take part. And, like, if he's, you know, if they were in the same room, like, she would stick her middle finger up behind his back and just disrespect him and just be really horrible and nasty. But Steve loved her so much, and he put up with a lot of her erratic and abusive behavior just so he could make life easier for everyone. Now, like I said, maybe she, like, was embarrassed of Steve because he was so much older than her. But either way, she would exclude him from things. And one example of this was Celeste decided to host this massive, massive 18th birthday party for Christina and Jennifer. Like, imagine something like, you know, My Sweet 16th, that show on MTV. I don't even know if that's the name of the show. I think it was My Sweet 16, wasn't it? Yeah. Anyway, imagine something like that. That's what you need to imagine for this party. It was Christina and Jennifer's 18th birthday. Celeste had this massive party thrown. In total, like, the party cost about 10 grand just for one night. And it wasn't just like your standard 18th birthday party with, like, a DJ and drinks and stuff. No, there was literally male strippers and an open bar. So it was wild. But Steve wasn't there. He wasn't even invited. And he was the one paying for all of this. Part of me thinks it was because Celeste was, like, embarrassed to be seen with him. And, like, embarrassed that it, you know, like, it would be obvious to, like, all her friends and everybody that she was a gold digger, you know, like, that she was with this much older man for his money. But she didn't even bother inviting him to his own now legally adopted daughter's 18th birthday party. So she was really, really treating him badly. But again, like we said, treating people badly wasn't a new type of behavior for Celeste. It wasn't odd for her. This was who she was, and she was not going to let her kids or her husband hold her back from partying. And this only got worse as things went on. Celeste would actually start spiking Steve's drink. She would put sleeping pills in his food, all so that way she could make him pass out, and then she could go out and be with whoever she wanted, carry on affairs, go drink, go party, go crazy. She would basically drug him and then leave him at home. Plus, if that wasn't like sick enough, her spending got even more out of control. The girl said that like their mother would almost get into this like manic state when she would spend a lot of money. It would almost like give her a weird buzz or something. And they said basically anything Celeste wanted, she got. If it was a new car or multiple new cars, or even just like being so crazy that she had to get up in the middle of the night and go shopping to buy like towels for the bathroom, or you know what I mean? Weird things like that. Like she was so addicted to shopping that she would get up in the middle of the night and say, we need to get new towels. And she would get the two girls, get into the car, and she would go drop a load of money on towels. You know what I mean? Like it, she couldn't control it anymore. The urge to shop and spend money was absurd. So then when Steve found out how much she was spending and how crazy it was getting, he found out that she racked up another $300,000 in debts. And he started to get really annoyed about this. And he actually threatened her with a divorce, because he had given her everything she wanted, and it was never enough for him, for her, sorry. It was never enough for her. He had given her now $1 million between the prenup, like the money in the prenup agreement. He had been giving her thousands in an allowance. He had been paying for everything for her and the two kids. Like, he just couldn't, he couldn't sustain her shopping habits. Like, he was truly like I can't give you more. Like, so like he had to try and, I guess not like scare her, but like warn her in some way, where like he was saying to her, you can't keep going on like this. Because bear in mind, like a daily shopping spree for Celeste could go from anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 easy. Like she was racking up debts all the time. Like it was constant. She would drop thousands in a day. So her and Steve were arguing about this all of the time, and the problem was most of the time she would be able to charm him and he would just let her off the hook. So like she was getting away with a lot. However, she way overstepped the mark when one day Steve got a phone call from his bank saying that Celeste was taking jewelry out of his safety deposit box behind his back. And this wasn't just, you know, any old jewelry. This was Elise's jewelry. It had belonged to his first wife. And he flipped. He flipped. He couldn't understand it, because he had given Celeste fortunes worth of her own jewelry. She did not need any of this stuff, but she was just taking it without permission because she was greedy and she did not respect any of his limits. This time, Steve was very unhappy and he was serious about it this time. And he could not stand his wife stealing from him anymore. Like, all the money that he had given her was never going to be enough. All the money that he had put into her accounts, it was never going to be enough. And so now she was actively going behind his back into his safety deposit boxes and stealing things from him. And he was at his wit's end. By early 1999, he was actually filing for divorce from Celeste. Now, this was the real deal. This wasn't just like Celeste, if you do this again, I'm going to have to divorce you. Or, you know what I mean? He was actually doing it this time. This wasn't just going to be another argument where she spends, you know, a bunch of money, racks up a ton of debt, and he forgives her. No, he was filing for divorce in early 1999. Now, Celeste didn't want to lose out on all of Steve's money. She knew that if they got divorced, that, you know, she might get a few million in their divorce settlement, but like that wasn't enough for her anymore. She wanted to be a multi-millionaire. And again, she tried charming him and apologizing for her behavior. She tried buttering him up, but this time it was not working. After she stole the jewelry, Elise's jewelry, from the safety deposit box, it was done, and Steve was preparing to divorce her. So when the charm and the, you know, the I'm so sorry, Steve, like when that didn't work this time around, what does Celeste decide to do? Well, she decided to get a gun and she stuck it to her head and she threatened to kill herself in front of her daughter, Christina. That's right. She started pretending that she was so suicidal at the thought of Steve divorcing her that she was going to blow her brains out in front of her teenage kid. And I'm saying that like flippantly because this was not a serious suicide attempt. Celeste was not depressed about the divorce. And if you think I'm exaggerating, I'm not. She didn't even bother to load the gun. She was just doing it to be dramatic and cause hysteria and distress to her teenage daughter and also to Steve, because she knew that if Christina was upset and Christina was devastated and afraid for her mother, that Steve would probably be more sympathetic towards Christina and he would take it easier on Celeste. So she was doing this to make Steve feel pity for her, and guess what? It worked. Steve had never really wanted to break up the family. He loved Christina and Jennifer, and he also loved Celeste. Even though he was at the end of his rope with her, like, he loved her. He never wanted to break up the family, and he was an old-fashioned man. You know, marriage meant a lot to him, and, you know, divorce really was not something he wanted. He saw marriage as a lifetime commitment. It's just he was married to someone who was absolutely out of control. So, like, Steve knew that he probably had to divorce Celeste, but if she was going to keep, like, swinging a gun around and threatening herself and, you know, all this carry on, like, he knew he had to, like, get her into a more stable, I guess, state of mind before he could do anything else. So he, you know, he decided that he wouldn't go through with the divorce immediately. Instead, after this latest suicide threat, he checked Celeste into a mental psychiatric center. So that way she could get treatment and hopefully maybe like some medication or something, so that way she could be a little bit more under control and a little less chaotic and crazy. And maybe, I'm guessing he was hoping, like, life might go back to normal the way it had been for the family. That's all he wanted. That's all the girls wanted. They just wanted their life to be stable, safe, content. But, like, Celeste was so cuckoo at this point that, like, they didn't know what she was going to do next, you know? So Celeste went to this mental psychiatric center. It was named St. David's Medical Center for Mental Health in Austin. And if you thought this was like your average psych ward, no. This was a very exclusive medical center. And I think, you know, I read someplace, it might not be true, but I wouldn't be surprised. It said that it cost $1,200 a day for Celeste to stay at this mental center. Now, Celeste was at St. David's as a patient for a few days. And it was at St. David's where she would meet a woman that would change the Beard family's life forever. Now, Tracy Tarleton was also a patient at St. David's at the same time as Celeste was. Tracy has bipolar, and she had been in and out of psych wards multiple times throughout her life dealing with her bipolar disorder. Now, Even though she came from a very successful Texas family, she had a very rough childhood and she was abused by her mother, who was an alcoholic. Eventually, Tracy went to the University of Texas and she began managing a bookstore in Austin. And the other thing about Tracy was that she was openly a lesbian. So bear that in mind. Now, on the surface, it seemed like Tracy and Celeste didn't have a lot in common besides the fact that they were both being treated for depression. But Tracy was immediately drawn to Celeste and they kind of started to bond with each other as they were at St. David's. Now, again, going back to her childhood, which we know was abusive and horrible, Tracy had been looking for love her whole life. And she needed this, you know what I mean? She wanted a relationship. She wanted love her whole life. She did not get a lot of it growing up. So she was at a very low, vulnerable point in her life when she met Celeste. And after a whole month with Celeste at St. David's, they started to become very close and they became very attached to each other. And I don't know how attached Celeste was, maybe it was an act, but Tracy was very attached to Celeste. And so even after they were both discharged from St. David's, they continued seeing each other after they had both been released. So after she's released, Celeste moves back into the family mansion and, you know, Steve accepts Tracy as his wife's friend. He, you know, they know each other. He accepts that they met each other in this hospital and now they're friends and they're spending a lot of time together. However, the twins were a lot less naive than their elderly stepdad. It was very obvious to the teenage girls that Tracy and Celeste were not just friends, that they were having some sort of an intimate affair. It was very obvious to Christina and Jennifer and their other friends that the two women were together. Like, just based on the way that they would touch each other and smile at each other, like, it made it very clear that this wasn't just a platonic friendly relationship. This was an intimate relationship. But you have to remember, it wasn't that odd for Celeste to have affairs. She had affairs all the time. Everybody knew it, you know. Every couple of weeks, she would be hooking up with someone new. However, for Tracy, this wasn't just a lighthearted fling, you know. She had gotten very attached to Celeste while they were in St. David's together. And then once they were released, they were spending every single day together. She was with Celeste all of the time. And Tracy was so consumed with Celeste that she began changing her behavior and her personality and even how she looked in order to make Celeste more happy with her. Like, Tracy had been, you know, described as a bit of a tomboy. And like, she was openly a lesbian, she was openly gay, and she wasn't really like concerned with her appearance as much as Celeste was. Celeste really cared about how she looked. So Tracy started getting manicures for herself. She started getting her hair done. She started wearing more feminine clothes, all to impress Celeste. But obviously, because of this new relationship / affair that Celeste was carrying on with Tracy, things in the Beard Mansion were getting more and more toxic. They were getting closer and closer to each other. And Celeste starts telling Tracy that Steve is abusing her. Meanwhile, Steve is getting more and more concerned about the relationship between Celeste and Tracy. He, I think, initially was very happy that, like, Celeste had found a friend at St. David's. But I think after a little while, even he started catching on that, like, this was not just a normal friendship, that there was a lot more going on here. And he started getting more and more uncomfortable with it, obviously. He tried putting a bit of distance between Celeste and Tracy, and Celeste just ignored him. Like, she did not care what Steve wanted. She did not care about anybody but herself. And a perfect example of this is when the two twin girls were having their graduation ceremony from high school. Celeste and Steve went along to the ceremony to support them. But Celeste also invited Tracy to the ceremony. And like, Tracy didn't even know the girls, you know what I mean? Like, she was just, like, she was only there for Celeste, you know what I mean? Like, she wasn't there because she cared about the girls. She wasn't there because, you know, she was cheering them on, like, for graduating. You know, she was there because Celeste wanted her to be there. And it was just very, very odd. Like, there's actually video footage of the graduation ceremony. And you can see Celeste and Steve sitting together. And in the row of seats directly below them is Tracy sitting on her own. And like, it's just so odd. Like, the fact that this woman is sitting there with her husband beside her and her girlfriend in front of them, and they're just like clapping, and it's just so odd and so bizarre. And I felt so sorry for Steve, and I felt sorry for the two girls as well, because like, they knew what was going on. Like, they knew what their mother was up to. And like, can you imagine like that being in your face at your high school graduation ceremony? Like, it would be so embarrassing. And like, if that wasn't bad enough, later that night, of course, Celeste throws another massive party, this graduation party, and she doesn't even throw it at their house. She throws it at Jimmy Martinez's house for the two girls. And once again, Steve isn't even invited to be there. Like, that's how messed up this is. Like, it drives me crazy. Like, she was just using this man so much and treating him so horribly. But anyway, again, like, if she couldn't be more like self-obsessed, she's not just like throwing this party at her ex-husband's house. She also invites Tracy to this party. And like, it's like, he's your ex-husband. This is your girlfriend. And you're also married to a man. Like, it's such a mess. But like, as usual with all of Celeste's parties, like, there's a lot going on, and I'm sure there's a lot to drink. And Tracy started to get very drunk, and she started to get a bit too openly friendly, shall we say, with Celeste at the party, and Jimmy decides to send her home. I think, like, at one point Tracy was trying to like kiss Celeste, or they were caught by somebody kissing. Something like that happened anyway, and basically Tracy had to be sent home. Like, this is just so messy. It's awful. Now, again, while all this crazy stuff is going on, Steve is once again trying to repair his marriage with Celeste. Despite all of his wife's crazy behavior and the fiasco at the graduation, Steve only wanted his family to be a unit again. He just wanted them to be happy together again. He wanted to get Celeste away from Tracy and to get her away from Jimmy. And he just wanted him, her, the two girls, he just wanted them to be happy again. So now that the girls had graduated, he wanted to take the two girls and Celeste on like this extended, very fancy European holiday. And it was the start of October. It was like the 1st of October. He, Celeste, Christina, they were all at home packing for the trip. Jennifer was out with her friends that evening. And like, you would imagine for someone like Celeste, this would be, you know, like, very exciting, because normally when she's going on a vacation or a trip with Steve, like, she can spend whatever she wants. She knows it's going to be luxurious. So normally Celeste would be like on cloud nine, getting ready to go on this European holiday. However, Celeste was acting odd that evening, and nobody really knew why. So everyone went to bed. However, later that night, at around 3 o'clock in the morning, on the 2nd of October, 1999, someone broke into the Beard Mansion. The intruder passed by the swimming pool, crossed the patio, and then opened the sliding door and entered the master bedroom where Steve was asleep that night, alone in bed. Celeste, conveniently, was sleeping in a different bedroom that night. She said the reason for this was actually she didn't usually sleep at all in the same room with Steve because his CPAP machine was loud and it would keep her awake at night. The mansion, just so you can kind of visualize a little bit, it actually had a very modern design, and the master bedroom was in its own wing of the house, and then the girls' room were in a different wing of the house, so there was actually some distance between the bedrooms, if you know what I'm saying. So this intruder came directly into Steve's bedroom, where they pointed a shotgun that they had brought with them at Steve, and then they shot him in the stomach with the shotgun before fleeing the scene. So Steve immediately wakes up. Somehow he manages to call 911 himself after being shot in the stomach with a shotgun. He tells the dispatcher, quote, "I need an ambulance, hurry. 3900 Taro Canyon Road, hurry. My guts just jumped out of my stomach. They blew out. They blew out of my stomach. I'm in awful pain." And so it's evident from this phone call that, like, Steve actually didn't realize he had been shot. He knew something happened to him, but he didn't know that he had been shot. He didn't see an intruder. He didn't, you know, he was, like, deep asleep. And maybe if he had a CPAP machine on, he might not have been able to, you know, hear as well what was happening in the room. He did not know what had happened to him. All he knew was he woke up in pain. His blood, his innards were, like, literally coming out of his stomach. And he needed to get an ambulance quickly. So when the police first get to the house, they actually can't find a way into the mansion. Like, this is crazy. Despite all the sirens and the police banging on the doors, no one let them into the house. So an officer actually went around to the back of the house and smashed a glass door to get in from the outside. And thankfully, the paramedics are able to get into the house quick enough to help Steve. They found him alone in his bedroom, holding his hands over the wound in his stomach. But, like, his intestines were visible, and he was in such a critical condition that the medical people actually airlifted him to hospital. So by this point, now the police, the emergency people, they're in the house, and this was clearly enough to get Celeste out of bed. So she starts screaming her head off in the hallway, telling the EMTs not to let Steve die. Meanwhile, Jennifer and Christina, they've also come to the bedroom, and they're panicking and crying. They were so confused. At this point, you know, they didn't know anything about the intruder, who was long gone. As far as they could see, Steve was having some kind of a medical emergency, and he was bleeding out a lot of blood from his abdomen, but they didn't know the full story yet. As far as they knew, this was just like a middle of the night emergency. Something was happening to him. They did not know that he had been shot at this point. It wasn't until a police officer came into the bedroom and noticed a yellow shotgun shell on the carpet near the bed that they realized that the house was actually a crime scene. That they realized, like, Steve hadn't just had some sort of a medical emergency in the middle of the night. They realized that, you know, when they looked around, that the place had kind of been staged to look a bit like a robbery. Furniture had been thrown over, drawers had been pulled open. And the police started to notice that Celeste's behavior was a bit odd. You know, she would have no emotion. She would have no emotional expression. But then if somebody kind of looked at her, she would spontaneously start fake crying to act as if, you know, she had been very upset. And one police sergeant, Greg Truitt, noted that Celeste said, like, she actually said this, quote, "This is perfect timing. We were supposed to go to Europe tomorrow." Now, I don't know if she said that in a, like, sarcastic kind of flippant way, but either way, he noted it down because he said that it was, like, so odd that his wife would say something like this after her house had just been broken into and her husband had been shot. You know what I mean? Like, why are you worrying about your holiday to Europe being disrupted? Like, this was not normal. Most people would be scared. Most people would be very upset. They wouldn't be worrying about their holiday plans. You know what I mean? And then another thing that happened was the girls said their mother warned them, you know, when the police weren't looking, if they were asked who had shot their stepfather, they were not to mention Tracy's name. Why would she feel the need to say that if it wasn't something she was trying to hide? They found it very odd. And thankfully, they told the police about Tracy's affair. Poor Steve is currently in the hospital fighting for his life at the same time that Celeste and the twin girls are taken in for questioning. And they also test Celeste and the two girls. They test their hands for any traces of gunshot residue. The detectives were asking them questions like, do you know anyone who had anything against Steve? Maybe he had a disgruntled business partner, or maybe he fired an employee. However, the girls told the police that they did not know a single person who didn't like Steve apart from Tracy Tarleton. Jennifer and Christina knew Tracy was obsessed with their mother and that, you know, she and Celeste both wanted Steve out of the picture. However, they did not want Celeste to find out that they had told the police about her and Tracy's relationship. Thankfully, they did the right thing. They told the police about the affair, but they were very scared that their mother would find out that they had told her secret to the police. And they also told the police that their mother had warned them if they were asked who could have shot their stepfather, they were not to mention Tracy's name at all, which they found very odd. Like, why would she feel the need to say that if she wasn't trying to hide something about Tracy? So the police immediately were suspicious of Celeste and of Tracy. However, thankfully, Steve was able to recover in hospital from the gunshot wound, which was just like a miracle, if you ask me. He had massive internal injuries from being shot. But, you know, he was able to get rest, he was able to recover, and he was in hospital and he was safe. Meanwhile, the police were focusing in on Tracy, who they now know is Celeste's lover, and they start questioning Tracy about the shooting of Stephen Beard. They come to Tracy's house and they start asking her questions, and she admitted that she and Celeste were having an affair. They asked Tracy if she owned a shotgun and she said yes. So the detective asked to see the weapon, and, you know, she kind of thinks about it for a minute, and then she allows them to see her 20 gauge shotgun, which actually had her name inscribed on it. They take the gun and they test it. And they found that this shotgun was a ballistic match to the shell found in Stephen's bedroom. And so 6 days after this, they arrested Tracy for the attempted murder of Stephen Beard. Now, most people would be distraught to hear that, for one, their lover had tried to murder their husband, and now their lover was being arrested for murder, and their husband was close to death in hospital. But not Celeste. No, she was not crying and worrying about anybody. She just spent her time shopping instead. She spent about $80,000 on jewelry, and she was also desperate to find out if her allowance had been paid out this month so she could pull it out of her account and go to Lake Charles in Louisiana to go gambling with it. She was completely off the rails. Steve, who was in hospital and, you know, now suddenly more preoccupied with his own mortality after the attempt on his life, he decided to change his will to actually leave Celeste with more money, which just makes me so sad because, like, even after everything she had done to him, like, he clearly couldn't stop loving her or caring about her, even after her lover tried to murder him. But even after surviving the gunshot wound, and even after he spent 4 months in hospital, and he was doing very well, Steve's health had begun to suddenly decline. And tragically, on January the 22nd, Steve passed away after getting a blood clot, which was actually ruled as a complication from the gunshot wound, and he was dead at the age of 74. Now, this was a terrible shock to everyone who loved him, because after he had recovered from the gunshot wound, for him to die so suddenly from this blood clot, it was awful. It was devastating for Christina and for Jennifer especially. They had looked up to Steve. They had cared about Steve and he had cared about them. It was also devastating for his three adult children to think that he had survived this murder attempt. He had lived for 4 more months, and then for him to just suddenly die of a blood clot, like, everyone was brokenhearted. Steve was laid to rest beside his first wife, Elise, at the Cook Walden Capitol Park Cemetery and Mausoleum in Texas. Now, this was when life started to get very scary and worrying for Christina and Jennifer, because he had been the main stabilizing force in their lives. He had cared about them, and he had only wanted their mom to be stable and happy. But now he was completely gone. He was completely gone. They were suspicious that Celeste was involved in his death. They knew Tracy was definitely involved, and so they suspected Celeste was involved, and they just did not know what she was going to get up to next. Now, at the time of his death, Steve was worth about $10 to $12 million. And because he had just changed his will, he left a lot of that money to Celeste. Half of his Taro Canyon home was going to Celeste, as well as half of his Lake Travis home. Personal property. He also left her 50% of the Stephen F. Beard Revocable Trust, which were, you know, made up of assets worth about another $6.5 million altogether. And what he didn't leave to Celeste, the rest Steve left to be split up between his five children, between Stephen Jr., Becky, Paul, Christina, and Jennifer. But after his death, Celeste was in an immediate scramble to get her hands on money. And she was very upset because the bank actually put a hold on her inheritance. That's not to say that they weren't giving her anything. No, they were still giving her a lot of money. It just wasn't enough. Celeste wanted more from the bank. And I kind of wonder, maybe Steve had stipulated that she get the money in installments, because he probably knew that she would just blow through all of it otherwise. Anyway, Celeste needed money urgently, and she decided to send Jennifer and her boyfriend at the time to gather up all of her bags and bags and bags of unworn clothes that still had the tags on them. And she made Jennifer and her boyfriend fill up the car. That's how much there was. Like, I don't think you realize. There were so much clothes that she had never worn that it was enough to fill up the car. And she sent them to return all of the clothes. Now, the amount that had been returned to the stores, like, it was so huge that the stores literally couldn't afford to give her cash back. They had to give Celeste store credit of close to $25,000. I'm not even making that up. Like, it was close to $25,000 when they combined all the different store credits that they had between, like, department stores and, like, designer stores. And, like, the two girls were so embarrassed. Like, they were so embarrassed by this. They could not believe their mother's behavior was getting this out of control. That she just had, like, 25 grand worth of unworn clothes just lying around. But, like, Celeste didn't care that the girls were embarrassed. She didn't want to have to go and return all this stuff herself. She sent them out to do it. Because she didn't treat them like they were her daughters that she cared about their feelings. Like, she treated them more like assistants than children, you know what I mean? And, like, she would manipulate everyone in her life, and she did the same thing to her own kids. So she didn't care that they were embarrassed and mortified that they had to do this. She needed the money to enjoy herself. And, you know, she told people that, she, you know, she was so distraught about Steve's death that she actually needed to check herself into a clinic. But instead, she just traveled to New Orleans to go party at Mardi Gras. So, like, you know, she did not stop at all. She didn't even stop long enough to pretend to be sad. Oh, and if you thought she was, like, holding out for Tracy and pining for Tracy, you'd be very wrong. She moved on quick, and within 5 months of Steve's death, Celeste had married another man. But don't worry, I'll get into that part later. So, now going back to Tracy, because she's the one in custody after all. Tracy was out on bail for shooting Steve. However, the police were still very suspicious of Celeste, and they felt that she most likely, definitely had a hand in her husband's shooting. So they knew she was running out of money, and suspicion and pressure on her was heating up big time. And one evening, Celeste saw her name on TV. She saw that her name was being brought up in connection with her husband's shooting. And she just cracked. Like, the pressure got too much for her. And she actually asked Christina and Jennifer if they would kill themselves with her. That's how nuts she was getting. She wanted to, like, murder-suicide her and her two daughters, basically. So the two girls now were very, very scared of their mother. She was so unpredictable. They didn't know if she was going to harm herself at any moment. They didn't know if she was going to, like, pull out a gun like she had done in the past. They didn't know if she was going to, like, ask them to kill themselves. They didn't know if she was going to jump out of a car. Like, they did not know what she was going to do. And maybe they convinced her, or maybe she realized herself, but Celeste checked herself back in for treatment at St. David's for a few weeks. But I don't think, maybe she didn't take it seriously, or maybe she was just doing it for sympathy. I don't know. I don't think she was there to really get help. She was just there, I think, to get away from the chaos that she was creating and the suspicion that people were kind of putting on her. So it didn't take long. She wasn't at St. David's for long this time, and she started calling Christina and asking her to come pick her up from St. David's. But Christina was literally too scared to go get her own mother, so Jennifer ended up agreeing to go pick up their mother. And she smartly brings along her boyfriend Chris, basically as backup when they go to pick up Celeste from St. David's. And Celeste was furious. She was so pissed off that Christina had disobeyed her, and Christina hadn't done what she wanted when she wanted it. So while they're driving back from St. David's, Celeste actually called up Christina, who was back at the house. And I don't know, I don't know if it was the first time, I don't know if she had done this multiple times, but Christina decided to secretly record the phone call from her mother. So I'm going to read out the dialogue from this recorded phone call, and you're going to see just how manipulative Celeste is. And I want you to imagine that in this conversation, Christina's tone is very passive and quiet with her mother, whereas Celeste's tone is very confrontational. So again, Celeste is driving back home from this mental facility, and she calls up Christina because she's so pissed off that Christina wouldn't pick her up and she had to have Jennifer pick her up instead. So Celeste says, "Christina?" Christina says, "Yeah, I'm here." Celeste said, "What are you saying by deliberately disobeying me, huh?" Christina says, "I don't know." Celeste says, "What don't you know? Because I'm a worse person than my father who molested me. Is that what you don't know, huh? 'Cause I've been that cruel to you?" Christina says, "No." Celeste said, "Then why would you say that I hurt you worse than my dad hurt me?" Christina says, "Because you do." At that point, Celeste starts screaming down the phone at Christina, saying, you know, kind of unintelligible things, but it's screaming. And I'm guessing it was something related to her abuse. And Christina says no. And then Celeste says, "Do you know what that feels like? Huh? How dare you say that to me? As soon as I get home, I feel like sticking a knife down my throat, you bitch." And at that point, Celeste starts crying and then ends the phone call with her teenage daughter, Christina. So that just tells you the stay at St. David's did not do much. So after that, Celeste is still in the car. And meanwhile, like, you know, Chris and Jennifer are still in the car with her. They've heard what she said to Christina on the phone. And they're driving back to the house with this crazy woman in the back seat. And she's so angry. Even after she's like vented on the phone to Christina and called her a bitch and said all this stuff, Celeste is still so livid that she told Jennifer and Chris in the car that she said to them, "I could kill Christina." So for Chris and Jennifer and Christina, this was the final straw with Celeste. Like, the threats and the tirade in the car were just too much for them after everything Celeste had already done. And like, in their own words, the girls said, like, there weren't enough locks on the door for them to feel safe being in the same house as their mother. However, like, even after all the suspicions and her crazy behavior and her violent threats, the two girls still couldn't agree on their mother's involvement in Steve's death. Jennifer thought that Celeste was definitely involved, but Christina still wasn't fully convinced. Now, you have to remember, Christina was the one who had lived the longest with her mother, and she was the one that was the most manipulated by her mother. She was the one who had been the most bullied by her mother, and Christina had never, ever stood up to Celeste, you know. She wanted her mother's approval and love above all else, even though she knew that her mother was unstable and selfish and dangerous and cruel. And I think it's because Christina and Celeste were closer than Celeste and Jennifer were. I think that's why when Christina refused to do what her mother wanted and pick her up from St. David's that night, I think that triggered like such an angry reaction in Celeste. Like, that, you know, I think it triggered something in her because Christina had always done what she had told her to do. She had always done exactly whatever Celeste wanted. And so, like, for her to stand up to her mother, I think it really shocked Celeste. And that's why she became so angry, like so irrationally over the top angry that she was calling her a bitch and saying that she could kill her and saying that she wanted to stick a knife down her own throat. And like, it made her like unhinged, the fact that Christina was not obeying her anymore. And as if like the stuff that she had said that night wasn't bad enough, the next day, Christina got another phone call from her mother, which she recorded again. And in this phone call, Celeste says, quote, "What are you so frightened of? You think you know me, but you don't. When you come home, I was going to tell you. I hired someone to kill Tracy." Now, this was the phone call that officially changed everything. It changed Christina's mind completely. It told her everything, you know what I mean? It completely solidified her mother's guilt. Every doubt that she had had, every hope that she had had that her mother wasn't involved in Steve's death, it was gone, because Christina knew that the only reason her mother had a reason for wanting to shut up Tracy for good was if she had actually put her up to killing Steve, if she had actually convinced Tracy to kill Steve. So now the twins had this recorded on tape, and they were very, very, very afraid that their mother could very easily turn on them too. They knew from all the years living with her how vindictive Celeste was. They knew after she had Steve shot in his bed that she had also put a hit out on Tracy. And they had no way of knowing who she was going to dispose of next. They knew that they had never been like a priority in their mother's lives. And they did not expect anything to change anytime soon. Celeste only did what was best for her. And just being honest, they were probably worried that like she could kill them for their share of Steve's money. Remember, like they had two portions of Steve's, what would you say? Not the trust, but like basically his assets. They had two portions of it. And even though their mother got the biggest portion out of anybody, it was never going to be enough for her. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if she would take their money as well. So to protect themselves, Christina and Jennifer decide to go to the prosecutor's office with the taped phone recordings. They brought letters, they brought any evidence that could back up their suspicions against their mother. And it was around the same time that the girls went to the prosecutor's office that the prosecutors got another break when finally Tracy was convinced to turn on Celeste. All this time, Tracy had refused to turn in Celeste, despite all the pressure on her to do so. But it was finally at this point that Tracy was convinced to testify against her former lover in return for a shorter sentence. And it wasn't because she was scared of going to prison, and it wasn't because she was scared of, you know, the death penalty or anything like that. She was finally convinced to tell the truth about what Celeste had done when she realized that Celeste didn't actually love her in return. Because while Tracy was in prison, she read an article about Celeste marrying this guy named Spencer C. Johnson 5 months after Steve's death in July of 2000. Spencer was this 38-year-old carpenter, and he would be Celeste's fifth husband. And it was after she read this article that Tracy realized, like, Celeste had just lied to her. Tracy was crushed, and, you know, reality finally hit her that Celeste had just used her to take Steve out of the picture, get him out of the way, not so that way they could be together and their relationship could, you know, move on to the next level. No, it was basically so Celeste could get her hands on all of Steve's money and then move on with the next guy that she fancied, you know what I mean? So on March 28th, 2002, Celeste Beard was finally arrested and indicted on a capital murder charge. Now, while there was a lot of evidence against her, Celeste still had two things going for her in her favor. She still had her ability to manipulate and convince people to feel sorry for her. And she also had that big chunk of her husband's money to use to pay for her defense. Because let's be honest, you know, the more money you have, the better stuff you can buy with it, and that includes lawyers. So by early 2003, Austin was abuzz with the talk of the trial of Celeste Beard for the murder of her husband. And when I tell you, she underwent a makeover for this trial, you won't even believe what I'm saying until you see pictures. And I'm going to post pictures on the Instagram, so definitely go take a look. Celeste was barely recognizable as the same person when she walked into the courtroom. Gone was her big, curly, volumized blonde hair and all her blingy jewelry and all her fancy clothes and her, you know, confident, party-loving demeanor. Instead, this woman who walked in like she was like a whole different breed of animal. She was like, imagine like what you like stereotypically would say, like, you know, a very like conservative librarian would look like on the way to a church meeting. Like, that's what you need to imagine. Celeste now had pin straight, flat brown hair pulled back off her face. She was wearing wire-rimmed glasses. She wore no makeup, no jewelry. She wore a skirt, a grey skirt that went all the way down to the middle of her calf. And as if that wasn't bad enough, she was hopping around on crutches because her leg was in a cast. Apparently, she had fainted and gotten a spiral fracture in her ankle. And there was a rumour going around that the doctor had actually, you know, wanted to remove the cast before the trial because she didn't need it anymore. And that she had told him not to because she thought it would get her more sympathy in court. The defence was really trying to make it seem like Tracy's bipolar disorder was, you know, out of control and that she was completely deranged. De Guerin said that everything Tracy was saying at trial was, quote, either delusional or fabrications or lies or fantasies, but not the truth. Now, throughout the trial, Celeste would sit, you know, very quietly and primly beside her attorneys. She would give the odd little smile. She was really playing up this new character of this quiet, gentle little woman. She was trying to make people sympathize with her. You wouldn't know looking at her in court that she had a razor sharp temper. And a lot of people actually, when she would come in and out of court, like they would mistake her for one of the legal aides or something. You know, she did not seem like the person, the Celeste Beard that people knew her to be. So because the defense team was never, ever going to put Celeste up on the stand, the prosecution knew that they had to show the court who Celeste really was underneath the facade. They needed to, you know, show the real nasty, mean Celeste underneath her whole new demeanor. So they decided very cleverly to play the video footage of a deposition where she denied having any kind of physical relationship with Tracy Tarleton. They showed this video of her in court where she said she never had a relationship with her and that she never even asked Tracy if she was the one who shot Steve, which was just like a ludicrous lie. Like it was a flat out blatant lie that she never even bothered to ask her lover if she was even the one who shot her husband. You know what I mean? Like it was such a stupid lie that it showed everyone how used to lying Celeste was. Then when it was Tracy's turn to get up on the stand and testify against Celeste, Tracy had a very detailed story to tell. Tracy said that Celeste had been flirtatious with her from the first time she met her at St. David's. And she described how they moved from kissing each other to doing more, you know, serious sexual acts. She also said that from her perspective, they were in a serious relationship with each other. Tracy said that she loved Celeste and that she believed Celeste had loved her because she would tell her all the time that she loved her. So then Tracy really shocked the court because she testified that Celeste had tried to get rid of Steve multiple times in the past. Tracy explained that if, you know, Steve asked Celeste to pour him a drink or pour him a vodka, she would mix like crushed sleeping pills into Steve's vodka, saying sooner or later it'll kill him. Tracy also told the court that Celeste had asked her to order her a book called The Poisoner's Handbook, so that way she could cook a batch of botulism and poison Steve with it. Then Tracy described to the court how the whole conversation about shooting Steve came around. Tracy said Celeste was doing, you know, the thing that she was very well known for doing. She was acting pseudo-suicidal again, saying that she would just have to shoot herself instead of staying with Steve. That she was so miserable with him, that she was so abused, that she would rather shoot herself and be dead than be with Steve any longer. And then finally, you know, Tracy gave in and she said, fine, I'll do it. I'll get rid of Steve. And Tracy said she agreed to do this because she thought of all the torment and misery that Celeste had supposedly been dealing with for months at the hands of her husband. However, once Tracy agreed to get rid of Steve, everything after that was completely down to Celeste's plan. Celeste orchestrated everything. She orchestrated the time and the place of the shooting. And, you know, despite it being a murder trial, the atmosphere some days in this courtroom was very much like a circus. There were over 100 witnesses. Daguerrin at one stage like made a makeshift bed with a pillow and a blanket, and he pretended to be lying on the flat of his back like Steve did on the night he was shot. It was all a bit, you know, silly. He also decided to paint Christina and Jennifer as two gold diggers who had turned on their mother for profit. So, like, it was wild. And just to explain why he did that, basically, if Celeste was successfully convicted of Steve's murder, her share of Steve's fortune would basically be forfeit. And then that would all then be split between Steve's three older children and Christina and Jennifer. So technically, they did stand to benefit significantly if their mother went to prison. And Daguerrin was very quick to harp on that fact. He was calling them gold diggers. He was accusing them of betraying their mother for money and saying that they were setting her up, basically so that way they could have a bigger portion of the fortune. Now, the girls, thankfully, weren't scared to face off in court with Daguerrin, but they were scared to have to sit opposite their mother. Christina said, quote, her eyes were like daggers. They just dig at you. It's hard to sit across from someone who hates you so much. But what Daguerrin couldn't hide from the court and what Celeste couldn't pretend was when the prosecution decided to play the audio tapes that the girls had recorded. And now this, I think more than anything else, like more than any of the testimony, more than any of the, you know, video depositions, this audio recording, when it was played in court, like, there was no spinning it. There was no sugarcoating it. This showed who Celeste really was when she was screaming vicious abuse at her kids over the phone. Then they also had the recording of Celeste admitting that she hired someone to murder Tracy. It showed Celeste in her rawest, most ruthless form, you know what I mean? It tore her image that she had crafted into pieces. And I think it was almost better than having her on the stand, because there was no way that she could charm and act her way out of it. Like, this was her at her most evil, and everyone heard it, and there was no way for her to spin it and get out of it this time. And so Celeste just sat in the courtroom, like, crying and shaking her head while the recordings were being played. The audio tapes were like a real slam dunk for the prosecution. But then they also had very compelling testimony when Christina and Jennifer took the stand to tell the court how they had witnessed Celeste treating their stepfather before the shooting. They told the court that she would call him a fat fuck and she would call him a pig, and how she hoped that he would just die. And they also testified to walking in on Celeste and Tracy kissing each other one time, which went completely against their mother's allegation that she and Tracy were only friends. So it was very significant, the fact that the girls testified against their own mother, and it showed the court just how much she had pushed them past their limits. Now, when the trial wrapped up, the jury had the job of deciding if Celeste was guilty or not. They had to decide if she was, you know, not just guilty of being a bad person or being a horrible mother, but being guilty of capital murder. And this was a hard trial. You know, like, it's true, the twins did stand to gain more money if their mother was convicted. And it's true, Tracy wasn't the best witness on the stand. Like, she did have bipolar disorder. She did have mental illness. And it's true, Celeste was not the person who walked up to Stephen Beard and pulled the trigger. All the evidence convicting her of capital murder was largely circumstantial, so people were really worried that the jury might let her off. But finally, after weeks, the murder trial of Celeste Beard wrapped up, and on March 19th, 2003, the jury returned with a verdict to a very emotional courtroom. People were crying. People were very upset about this. They were, I think there was probably a lot of fear that Celeste would get away with murder. The twins and Steve's other children and loved ones, they had been waiting now for 3 years since his death to get justice. And thankfully, the jury found Celeste Beard guilty of capital murder. And it was a huge relief for everyone involved that the 12 members of the jury believed the largely circumstantial evidence against her. Now, after the verdict was delivered, Steve's son was speaking to the reporters outside, and he got very emotional, and he actually thanked Tracy Tarleton for doing what she did, for speaking out against Celeste. Even though she was the one who shot his father, he appreciated that without her testimony, that they would have never gotten justice against Celeste. And it was just really big of him. Like, I've never seen, you know, a victim's family member thank one of the criminals involved, you know. And it just shows that, like, Steve's family were able to forgive Tracy, because even though she was the one that pulled the trigger, they knew that she was just as much of a victim of Celeste's manipulations as Steve was. Like, they knew that just like Celeste was using Steve for his money, like, she was using Tracy just in the same way. So, you know, they could see Celeste was a very selfish and soulless person. Everything she was doing was just for her own gain, and she didn't care how much it cost other people. Before, you know, everything was wrapped up, Christina got on the stand to read a statement after the verdict was read, and she looked her mother directly in the eye as she said it. She said, quote, "What did I ever do to you but love you? And this is how you treated us. Like trash. You say we turned on you, but you turned on us. The whole Beard family. He let you into his home, loved you, honored you, obeyed you, and you violated him and murdered him. You are guilty. Shame on you." But even after hearing her daughter say this, Celeste didn't cry. In fact, she actually kind of smirked. But I don't know what else you'd expect from a woman who is as just narcissistic and evil as she is. So Celeste will most likely die in prison. But until then, she still holds on to her anger and doesn't forgive her daughters. She actually said at one point, quote, "It makes me sick. You always hear that blood is thicker than water. Not in my case. I want to call them the Menendez sisters." Celeste has also tried to demand that her monthly allowance from Steve's estate be continued, as well as demanding another sum of $500,000 to fund her appeal. However, this was also denied. And thankfully, instead, Steve's estate was split up between Stephen Jr., Becky, Paul, Christina, and Jennifer. Now, Celeste still denies any and all guilt in Steve's death, and any chance she gets to proclaim her innocence, she does. In a recent interview, she said that she regrets not being a better mother and not disciplining her kids. Then she began crying about how her life in prison is hell because she always takes care of the underdogs, and she was so upset because her mother is now 84 years old and she just wants to be able to take care of her mother, as if anyone would ever believe she would ever bother to take care of anyone else. Like, that never happened any other time in her life. And she's one of those people, like, when you watch her interviews, like, you hear them talk, and you just wonder, do they hear themselves before they talk? Like, do they listen to what they're saying before they say it? Like, it's kind of baffling how self-absorbed she is when she talks about anything. It's no matter what she's talking about, it is always about her. But thankfully, Celeste is still rotting away in the Mountain View unit in the highest security prison in Texas, where she belongs. Her first opportunity at parole is going to be in 2043. As for Tracy, she is now a free woman. She spent 10 years in prison, and the remaining 12 years of her sentence are on parole. But she's still haunted by this whole ordeal, and she still wakes up every single day feeling ashamed for what she did to Stephen Beard. As for the two twin girls, in October of 2017, Jennifer was living with a roommate. He was a guy named Randall Jones, and they were having a party, a Halloween party. They were throwing it at their place, and Randall ended up shooting and killing one of the other partygoers. And this wasn't all. He also ended up shooting a few other people, including Jennifer. And Jennifer needed multiple surgeries on her abdomen because she got shot 2 times in the stomach. Apparently, this all happened because people at the party had been trying to persuade Randall to go to bed because he was really drunk. But this only made him really angry. And so he got his gun and he fired off 12 rounds from a 40 caliber handgun inside the house. And Michael McCluskey was actually trying to subdue Randall from doing even more damage, which caused him to get like seriously wounded. And as a result, he died from his wounds. Jennifer now struggles physically from these injuries and she's unable to work. So she relies on the help, you know, she relies on help from her twin sister, basically. I would guess probably physically and financially. But apart from that, both of them like to keep their lives pretty private now. And I just wish them all the best in life, moving on from everything their mother put them through. And I wish the best for Randall's other 3 kids. I hope they're doing well in life as well. So I hope you guys enjoyed this case and we will talk soon in the next episode. Bye. If you'd like to see any of the interesting images I found while researching this case, please follow along to my Instagram account at Dark Emerald Podcast. Feel free to like, share, send me a message. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the case. Bye.